Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Last Thursday, you may remember the Supreme Court ruled that you cannot patent human genes, but if you've crafted synthetic genes, you can. Noah Feldman, Harvard Law professor and Bloomberg View columnist, wrote that while the Supreme Court ruling sounds sensible, it doesn't reflect scientific logic, his term. Here to explain that. Plus, we're still waiting for the rulings on the big cases to come down from the high court, the affirmative action case, the same-sex marriage cases, and the Voting Rights Act case. But a smaller one did come down this morning. It has to do with voter verification laws. The court says that a state cannot require a prospective voter to prove they are a U.S. citizen. So, Noah Feldman, welcome back to WNYC. Thanks for coming on.
Pleasure to be with you.
And let's start with the ruling today. The biggest case they decided today was this Arizona versus the Intertribal Council of Arizona. The court ruled that Arizona's proof of citizenship requirement conflicts with a 1993 federal law, the National Voter Registration Act, normally referred to as Motor Voter. So this means what? That no state is allowed to require proof of citizenship in order to register to vote?
In essence, that's correct, at least in terms of mail registration. But I think what's important is to see the context here. For the last several years, Arizona has been passing laws that in various ways were designed to communicate a message to at least some people in the state of Arizona that they really have to prove their citizenship. This is part of a policy aimed at maintaining legal immigration and discouraging illegal immigration. And I think the law in question here, which the Arizona law, which required that you provide affirmative proof, you know, a birth certificate, a driver's license that specifies citizenship, a passport before registering to vote, is part of that process. And each time that Arizona has done this, the Supreme Court has rebuffed its requests. And they've used different ways to do it, but in this case, they used this principle called federal preemption, which is just a fancy way of saying that if Congress passes a law, the states can't pass a law that contradicts it. And since Congress's law actually says that if you want to register to vote, we send you this form. On the form you sign saying, I am a citizen under pain of penalty of perjury, then you can vote. And that's what the court said had to win in this case.
And we should mention that this is not one of those voter ID laws, because this is not about presenting ID when you go to the polls to actually vote on Election Day. This is about a federal form that asks if you're a citizen, which you have to sign under penalty of perjury when you register to vote. And Arizona and just four other states, I think, tried to amend the process to require proof of citizenship when you register under motor voter. That's not allowed as per this ruling. Interesting to me that the decision was 7-2. Only Thomas and Alito dissented, and Scalia wrote the decision.
He did, and you can see Scalia's fingerprints on it because Scalia is interested in text. He considers himself a textualist, by which he means he likes to read the exact words of the statute. And here the words of the statute are accept and use. Congress requires that the states accept and use its forms. And so Scalia found it appealing to take this opportunity to say, well, if you've taken the form and you send it out, but then you add another form that in effect blocks that first form, then you haven't accepted it and used it under the language of the statute. And that's almost certainly why Scalia wrote the opinion.
Does this ruling give you any clues about what the justices may decide about the Voting Rights Act case, Shelby County versus Holder?
None whatsoever. That's about a much more fundamental question of whether a federal law that has been in existence since the Civil Rights era that was designed to monitor jurisdictions that historically were racist in their giving opportunities to vote and in their design of their districts is or is not still constitutional today. That implicates basic questions of what do you think the constitutional guarantee of equal protection really means? And this case doesn't go anywhere near that far, and especially as Justice Scalia wrote it, he didn't say anything about the context that I mentioned. He said nothing about race. He said nothing about Arizona in particular. He just focuses on the language of the statute.
All right. Well, we'll have to wait for that one. And in these last 2 weeks of their term, the in addition to the Voting Rights Act case, the affirmative action case, and the same-sex marriage cases. So, boy, they may be, you know, justices on the gray-haired Supreme Court of the United States of America, but they sure know how to build suspense as well as a Hollywood screenwriter. So we'll have to wait for those last days of the session.
They really are aware of the drama of it, and each time one of these days when they're going to announce opinions arises and we're not at the very tail end, and people say to me, oh, well, you know, maybe they'll decide the big case today. I said, don't count on it. They like the idea that the whole country is watching. I think it appeals to them. Most of their job is out of the limelight. They get 1 week or two per year at the end of June when they get to be in the driver's seat, and they're not going to waste it.
And they've said the next potential decision day is Thursday, so we'll be having a conversation, something like this, again in 3 days, hopefully with a more significant decision to talk about. All right, let's go back to the gene patenting case. Mm-hmm. This is Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics. The justices ruled that you cannot patent naturally occurring human genes. But you say it's not as simple as Justice Thomas made it seem in the majority opinion, and it was a unanimous ruling, and it sort of hinges on your understanding of the difference between complementary DNA and regular DNA. So as a layperson, I ask, huh?
Yeah, I mean, let me first specify that I'm not a molecular biologist myself, but here's how I understand the decision, and here's how I understand the basic underlying science. The court said that if something is a naturally occurring strand of DNA, that is to say, a strand of DNA that both includes part that codes for proteins and some other stuff that doesn't code for proteins. They're called introns. They don't code for proteins. And you replicate that order, you can't patent that order. But, said the court, if you take out the so-called introns, those elements of the chain of nucleotides that don't code for a protein, and you produce a strand of DNA that only has in it those nucleotides that code for the proteins, which is called complementary DNA, that, they said, counts as synthetic. It's not naturally occurring, and therefore you can patent it. Now, on the surface, that sounds perfectly reasonable. You know, if you find something that already exists in the world, you've discovered it, it's naturally occurring, and therefore under the judicial interpretation of the patent laws, you can't get a patent on it, whereas if you invent something which is not naturally occurring, you can get a patent on it. That's the sort of straightforward logic to it. What's unconvincing about this, in my view, is how actually technicians in a lab create the complementary DNA. And the answer is they take messenger RNA, which has already on its own by natural processes taken out all of the introns. It's taken out all of the nucleotides that don't code for proteins. And then you just apply reverse transcriptase or some other naturally occurring enzyme to your strand of messenger RNA, and boom, it gives you complementary DNA. So the order in which complementary DNA comes into existence, the sequencing, which is everything in genetics, was already naturally existing. The sequencing already naturally existed in the messenger RNA. So the courts claim that somehow complementary DNA is a synthetic creation is, you know, only true in the lawyer's way of using the word synthetic. And just to further underscore this, there are some viruses that do this. There are some viruses that will take messenger RNA and then produce complementary DNA.
So I'm as confused as ever, because you seem to be saying that complementary DNA, which they took to be naturally occurring, is really on some level synthetic. So maybe
I meant to be saying almost the exact opposite.
Okay.
The court says that complementary DNA is synthetic.
Right.
What I'm saying is, in some instances, it's actually naturally occurring.
Okay. So therefore, in the column you wrote, you seem to be saying the ruling will be bad for scientific research, and that if you don't have the incentive of a patent for gene identification, Big Pharma won't pay for research, and we'll all be worse off. But couldn't you also say that this ruling broke the de facto monopoly that Myriad had on this particular gene testing, and now other companies will offer the test, creating more competition, bringing down the price, which is good also for innovation?
Yes. I mean, the short answer is that every time you're faced with a question of whether to provide intellectual property protection for something, whether it's a patent or a copyright or a trademark, you're always trading off between giving the incentive for other companies in future cases to invest heavily in coming up with this form of property, or alternatively, whether other people will be able to take the property that's been created or the invention or the discovery and use it in a wide range of ways. That's the fundamental balance that's always present in a patent case. And in this case, you know, with respect to the existing DNA, the naturally occurring DNA, the court did, in fact, break the patent. And yes, one positive result of that is that the monopoly will be broken. One potential negative result is that in future situations, big pharma companies might hold back.
And we just have 10 seconds left, but they didn't do it for business reasons. They did it for the kind of, you know, big think ethical concern of not being able to patent part of a naturally occurring human being, right?
I would just say they split the difference. They cared about the big think because that sounds bad, but then they provided the patent on a complementary DNA because they're trying to provide some protection for big pharma.
Well, I must not be the only one confused because Myriad stock first went up 3% after the reading ruling and then crashed by 20%. So Noah Feldman, Harvard Law professor, Bloomberg View columnist, thank you very much for clarifying some of that.
Thanks for having me.